Good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions before we begin?
I have none, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Then, Mr. Hamilton, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am here speaking for the family of Clay Block. Mr. Block died at age 24. He was survived by his son, and then his fiancée later gave birth to his daughter after he was deceased. He's also survived by his parents and a brother. He was among friends in Wayne, Nebraska in 2017. They apparently hadn't seen each other for a while, so they thought they'd get together in the apartment of one of those friends. The building in which the apartment was located was in downtown Wayne. The first floor was a dental office operated by Stephen Becker. Mr. Becker, unfortunately, is now deceased. But on the second floor were two apartments. They were rented out by him.
When did Mr. Becker die?
I'm sorry?
When did Mr. Becker die? When did the defendant die?
After the lawsuit was underway, before any discovery was taken.
Has there been a substitution?
Yes.
Or a revival?
Yes.
Is that in our record?
Should be.
Okay. Thank you.
But in any event, the friends of Clay Block and he gathered in that apartment building on the second floor to get to see each other and talk about old times and that sort of thing. And, of course, they did consume some alcohol. The tenant...
Does the record indicate that your client or the deceased party here may have consumed a lot of alcohol?
Well, the amount, the measurement was in the tubes. The toxicologist lowered it from 2-something to 230-something. I'm not sure why. That, of course, is considered somewhat high, I think, by most standards. And but also we had testimony of those who were at the get-together that he was functioning reasonably well. He was not, one fellow said he wasn't wasted. Another fellow said he could speak coherently. The lady he was talking to most of the time said he could walk okay, and she considered him to be in decent condition. So he was, in my crude parlance, not falling down drunk. He was obviously affected by it somewhat. But
so all of those issues contributory negligence, or?
I'm sorry?
Are all of those facts, do they speak to contributory negligence or comparative negligence, or what's that all about?
Well, they do. And actually, the district court used that evidence essentially to grant the motion for summary judgment. He was of the opinion that the plaintiff could not prove causation, therefore the case should be dismissed, and he cited in his decision the fact that a toxicologist had offered testimony about what kind of condition a person would be in or could be expected to be in when they had consumed that much alcohol. But I have seen those tests before, and the one thing that stands out is that the way they do them is they have people volunteer to get drunk. They test them along the way at various levels, after one beer, after two beers, after three beers. And then they arrive at a conclusion about how the alcohol affects those folks. But the one thing I've always seen in those results is the statement that not everybody is affected the same way. Some have a better tolerance than others. Some can walk better than others, talk better than others. Better balance.
What impact does the consumption of alcohol have on causation?
Well, it makes it a little bit foggy, but the ultimate facts, I think, that make a difference for the plaintiff are these. They were Clay Block, 24, and a young lady who I think is 23, Lauren Harms, and the man named Sanchez were on this balcony on the second floor of the apartment building. The balcony is not huge, but it is a balcony in the sense that there is a railing between it and the ground. They were seated on the floor of the balcony, talking. They were seated face to face. He had his right shoulder towards the balcony, or towards the railing. She had her left. After a while, they decided to get up. They clasped hands, and as they were about halfway getting up, their hands broke apart. And at that point, Mr. Block went over the edge and landed on the concrete below and suffered massive head trauma and died.
So do we know, did he go over the railing or through the railing? Do we know that?
We know that he didn't go over because the witness said he didn't go over it. And it's the same
one. What happened to the railing?
The railing went down with him.
Pulled from the building?
Not pulled. Basically collapsed. If you look at the record, you'll see that it was in just horrible shape, horrible condition. It was a solid steel railing. It was no flimsy wooden railing. It was affixed to the wooden surroundings in the balcony by what they call lag screws. I think the carpenters among you will understand that those are screws that are designed to hold wooden, to drill into wood and hold the object tightly instead of, you know, loose. They're not little short things. They're that long, I think, 2 inches. There were at least 6 places where that balcony would be affixed to the railing would be affixed to the balcony. There were screws laying on the floor in the apartment before the balcony went over the edge. And the deputy sheriff who investigated the deceased, or the decedent's, the facts of the decedent's death, testified it was not ripped from the wall. And if you're a carpenter type, if you drill screws into wood that's outside, after a while, the water that gets in there will rot away the connection between the screw and the wood.
Was there an expert who testified to this, to what a carpenter would ordinarily know?
Well, no, but the deputy sheriff said that there was rotten wood that the screws were affixed to, and it wouldn't hold the railing very well.
And so did you have some kind of burden in the summary judgment process? And I guess ultimately, what is your complaint about what the judge did here?
Well, here's one of the things that struck me. Of course, if I can find the darn thing. From the judge's decision, and let me read it to you. He essentially decided that you could not properly infer that Mr. Block made physical contact with the railing.
Is this an error of law? Is it an error of the trial judge's analysis?
Well, I think it could be both because he, as far as I'm concerned, decided that he was incapable of making an inference because he believed that the witnesses did not support an inference by eyewitness testimony. Now, it's a very rare case involving a casualty where every fact could be verified by witnesses. So inferences, and I heard that word several times in your first argument, inferences are common. in a jury case where you have to rely on witnesses' testimony. But
did the trial judge take the inferences in favor of the non-moving party in this case?
I'm sorry.
Did the trial judge take the inferences in favor of the non-moving party?
No. Here's what the judge wrote. Thus, even though the decedent fell to his right into the railing, and the railing fell from the balcony along with the decedent, there is no evidence that an adequately secured railing would have stopped the decedent's momentum. He essentially decided what we were arguing, that our client fell or leaned on the railing, it gave way, and he went over the edge and he died. And he used that same belief of what the case facts were later on in his ruling.
Did the judge infer that there was greater than customary momentum due to the manner in which the decedent and the young lady stood up?
No. There was no inference to that effect. He just cited the evidence from the toxicologist that people don't walk very well, they don't function very well when they're intoxicated, and therefore the intoxication must have been the reason he fell off.
So did the judge basically say, you're not ever going to win this case with a jury?
He's saying the jury's going to be hard on you because of the presence of alcohol, is probably what he's saying. And I recognize that. But as they were standing up, some one of them, for whatever reason, lost the grip on the other. And that's what caused our client to lose his balance, lean or brush up against the railing, and have the railing go right over the edge. Now he, if the railing were not in such horrible condition, then we don't believe that he would have fallen over.
What is your best evidence that an adequately secured railing would have prevented the fall?
I'd have to believe that the best evidence would be the common life experiences of just about anybody that might sit on the jury. When I was contemplating what I was going to say today, I in my office, I have a little balcony with a railing behind my office, and I just go up and wiggle it. They're pretty strong if you really just put your hand on them. But what railings, I believe, are designed to do are actually to protect those who need protection the most, and that is little kids, to keep them from falling off, older folks who have a little trouble getting around, and...
Let me rephrase my question a bit. What's your best evidence in the record that an adequately secured railing would have prevented the fall?
I'm going to have to get back to you on that one. I'm trying to...
The deputy sheriff?
Yeah, he commented, without even being asked, that the railing was in very poor shape. The screws were loose or all out of the railing completely, and it wasn't safe. It simply wasn't safe, and I think he made that comment, if I'm not mistaken.
Did he comment on the? I want to say the application of the screws to the railing in some manner?
Well, he said that they weren't properly attached because of the rotten wood into which they were drilled.
Did he describe the nature of how they were affixed? Liquid nails, anything like that?
No, I didn't talk about liquid nails. See, the railing was affixed at various points on the wall and on the floor. and there were just little spiky things. You could not liquid nail it to the bottom. So I think I'm done, all right?
I think we've asked enough questions to get you beyond your time limit. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Didn't drink my water.
Mr. Keith, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you, Ron. May it please the court, Mr. Hamilton. My name is Rob Keith. I represent the appellee, Mountain Plains Research, and the estate of Stephen Becker, who did die during the proceedings and was properly substituted the estate during the proceedings. This case is basically factually undisputed. On June 8th of 2017, Mr. Bach did fall from a second floor window area. And one of the things I think that's important for everybody to understand is the use of the term railing and balcony. This was not a balcony, and it wasn't a railing. This is what's called a false mansard that was actually 2 feet wide by 7 feet long that three either adults or near adults were sitting on just prior to the fall. There is an expert whose affidavit is in the record that specifically says that the life safety code does not apply to a false mansard. A railing was not even required. It was simply a 2 foot decorative piece that was on this false mansard. It was not a place for human occupancy.
Was there anything in the record that the appellee had been provided notice by a prior tenant or anyone else that people were using it for an outdoor smoking area?
Yes, there was evidence of that, but the court decided the motion for summary judgment on an unrelated issue, not the premises liability instruction of whether the appellee knew or should have known, but on whether or not this false mansard and or railing were a proximate cause, a very narrow issue that didn't really reflect on whether or not the appellee knew or should have known about that railing or other people using the false mansard for smoking.
Does the record state whether the height of the railing?
It's 2 feet tall.
It's 2 feet tall.
Yes. I believe there's actually pictures in the record that shows a tape measure next to it. So on the night of this party, these three individuals go up there, and there was some discussion about whether alcohol was involved. The police report and autopsy found a blood alcohol level in excess of 0.3. We hired Henry Nipper, who his affidavit is in the record, who indicated that due to his calculations, it was 0.266. In addition to that, based on witness testimony, the decedent also had THC in his system from smoking marijuana, and combined those two created his opinion that you would lose a lot
of... Those all facts that we would normally consider to be contributory negligence?
Not in this case, Your Honor, mainly because we're not here on a motion for summary judgment that was awarded on comparative fault. We're here on a summary judgment that was awarded on proximate cause. And really the issue with the court...
So can there be more than one proximate cause of an accident?
Exactly. And that's the problem here, is because in the series of cases that this court has decided, normally a proximate cause is a jury issue, unless there's two or more reasonable inferences that can be drawn if there's not direct testimony as to the cause. And in this particular case, you have three individuals that are sitting on a 2x7 false mansard. You have the decedent who's facing... sitting up against a wall with his back against the to the right if you're looking out the window. You have another woman, Lauren Harms, who is sitting to her, the left of the window. And you have a third individual who's sitting in the window, all smoking cigarettes. They decide to go inside. Mr. Sanchez, who's sitting in the window, turns and exits through the window, testifies specifically in his deposition, "I didn't see the fall. I don't know how
did
it happened."
Did the expert say people never do or never should go onto this place?
It's not for human occupancy. It's decorative.
Was there a door once out to this mansard, or was there just always windows?
To my understanding, there was only windows out there. I saw a reference to that, but there was no proof that I was aware of. It's just a regular storm window.
So does our record contain evidence that the same witnesses, the woman on the outside the window and the gentleman in the window, gave different statements to the officers right after the fall than they gave in their deposition testimony later? And if the record does show that disparate testimony, who has the responsibility of resolving any dispute?
That's a great question, because there was a commingling of that term testimony used in the appellant's moving papers. And the reports to the police report are hearsay statements. Okay, and they were not.
Were they admitted into evidence on the motion for summary judgment?
As attachments to the depositions of those individuals, they were marked as exhibits and then offered as part of the paper record. Yes. So when they were asked a question about that, the police report, and I think it was Mr. Sanchez directly, said, is that what the report says? Yes. Then on direct testimony, what were you doing at the time of the fall? I was ducking my head in to the apartment. My back was to it. Did you see what happened? No, I didn't. So the only testimony that was been provided by either Ms. Harms or Mr. Sanchez, the only two witnesses, provide no explanation how the fall occurred.
Let me, does the plaintiff in this case have to disprove every other possible proximate cause?
No, they don't. But there has to be enough of information to allow a reasonable basis to choose one over the others. And in this particular case, you have someone who's severely intoxicated, who's sitting on a 7x2.
Isn't that the reasonableness of this? Isn't that really a jury question?
Not in an approximate cause analysis, because here you have someone who's intoxicated, who is now, at the time that they're trying to get up on this little area, this false mansard, they grab hands, and as they're pulling each other up, Ms. Harms testifies, my hand slips, and he falls back. Okay, so you have that potential cause. You have intoxication as a potential cause. You have lost balance as a potential cause. And then you have this railing to which no witness ever said he grabbed or leaned on to try to keep himself from falling over.
What about the fact that the railing goes down to the ground with Mr. Block?
Again,
an inference be drawn from that, at least that contact was made?
I think that contact was made, but whether it was a proximate cause, I don't believe so, because it's 2 foot high. You're going to have some contact as you're going over. One would assume if you're falling, you're reaching or grabbing for anything that you possibly can as you're going down. Is that one of the potential?
It's 2 feet high, but was it?
Is your argument he leaped over it?
No, that he fell. I mean, it's a decorative mansard. It's not there to keep you on the deck. The life safety cord code does not even apply.
So the condition of the railing has no impact?
I won't say no, because I believe what the court said is it's one of multiple potential proximate causes, only allowing the jury to speculate as to which proximate cause to pick.
How is it a proximate cause?
Well, that's a great question, but in all things have to be given to the inferences have to be given to the moving party. In this case, that's
Wasn't this suit also brought as premises liability suit?
No, it was brought as a negligence suit, and then we filed as part of our motion that it should be analyzed under a premises liability theory.
You said inferences given to the moving party. You meant non-moving party.
Non-moving party, excuse me. That's correct.
All right.
I prefer it my way, but that's probably not going to happen. And I'm sorry, I got addressed with the questions there. What were you saying, Judge? Your question?
I asked about the premises liability.
Oh, yes, premises liability. But the interesting part is, under negligence or premises, sole proximate cause or proximate cause is still the same test under either theory, but for and natural and continuous sequence. And that's what the court found that they failed to do, because there's too many alternatives to prove, other than allowing a jury to speculate, as to the but-for causation of this fall.
You've been talking about the railing being 2 feet high and evidence in the record that it was 2 feet high. Was there also evidence in the record that the railing was about waist high?
It was.
And if so,
yes.
And if so, who resolves that dispute?
There isn't one. And I'll tell you why, because that became from Lauren Harms, who, if you read the record, I believe is just about 5 foot tall. And if you read it a little clearer, it's below the waist. So there's not going to, there's actually, I'm not sure this photograph is in the record. I think it's in Kevin Godwin's report that has the tape measure laid up against it that specifically shows 2 feet in length.
So that may or may not be in our record.
I believe it is. It's in Kevin Godwin's affidavit, which attaches his report that has the photographs of his post-accident investigation.
So it's your argument that the railing was never intended to protect anyone going out onto the false mansard?
Exactly.
Is that relevant to proximate cause, or is that some other basis for summary judgment?
It's only relevant to proximate cause to the extent it creates another inference that we have to give to the non-moving party to make sure that that is their allegation. They're claiming that this was there to protect individuals who we knew We're on this false mansard. We have to address that. And so although it doesn't go to the underlying question of negligence of whether we should have done taken some action to keep these individuals off the false mansard, we have to say all it does is it creates another potential proximate cause that a jury is left to speculate and guess.
I don't want to waste your time, but maybe this is in the record. What's a Juliet balcony?
That's a great question, and it's not in the record, and I won't pretend to know. I've never heard of one. But because of that, this is a very narrow ruling that because of the multiple potentials, proximate cause, and the evidence that supports each one of those, that a jury can't be left to guess or speculate.
If there's evidence to support multiple potential theories, isn't that exactly what juries do? I mean, isn't the issue in our cases when a jury has to speculate with no evidence to determine between the two?
Based on the case law from this court, is that if there is not enough to show a reasonable basis that one is more likely than the other, it's just here's a litany of potential causes, then...
Well, since you brought it up, what has this court said about circumstantial evidence in civil...
It can be used, definitely, but it still has to create a reasonable basis that one potential proximate cause is more likely than another.
Is there any description that this railing or this two-foot thing reminds you of a railing and that a viewer would assume it's a railing?
There's no discussion.
What about the fact that you're way over time and we're getting argumentative?
That's okay.
What about the fact that these folks were sitting down, so it wasn't like they were standing up and could easily fall over the railing?
The appellant, Mr. Hamilton, said it best. When these two stood up, they grabbed each other to pull each other up, and their hands slipped. And so they weren't necessarily sitting at the time of the fall. There was this movement together to stand up, and the hand slipped, and you know how that action reacts, led to him falling over the edge. And unfortunately, there was really no... There was no sitting or protected that they were concerning about at that time. That he just fell. Based on that, the appellant or appellee would ask that this court affirm the lower court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No.
We don't. Counsel, that concludes arguments in Hoffman versus Becker. Thank you very much. You are excused. And the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Thies versus Royer.